"Who is that?" Gentle said. The sound was contagious and brought a smile to his face.
"It's Taylor," Clem said.
"There is no one here called Taylor," Benedict said.
"Well, he's here," Clem replied.
Gentle stood up and scanned the sleepers. In the far corner of the garden, Monday was lying flat on his back, with a blanket barely covering his paint-spattered clothes. A beam of morning light had found its straight, bright way between the concrete pillars and was settled on his chest, catching his chin and his pale lips. As if its gilding tickled, he laughed in his sleep.
"That's the boy who made the paintings with me," Gentle said.
"Monday," Clem remembered.
"That's right."
Clem picked his way through the dormitory to the youth's side. Gentle followed, but before he reached the sleeper, the laughter faded. Monday's smile lingered, however, the sun catching the blonde hairs on his upper lip. His eyes didn't open, but when he spoke, it was as if he saw.
"Look at you, Gentle," he said. "The traveller returned. No, I'm impressed, really I am."
It wasn't quite Taylor's voice. The larynx shaping it was 20 years too young, but the cadences were his, so was the sly warmth.
"Clem told you I was hanging around, I presume?"
"Of course," Clem said.
"Strange times, eh? I used to say I'd been born into the wrong age. But it looks as though I died into the right one. So much to gain, so much to lose."
"Where do I begin?"
Gentle said.
"You're the maestro, Gentle, not me."
"Maestro, am I?"
"He's still remembering, Tay," Clem explained.
"Well, he should be quick about it," Taylor said. "You've had your holiday, Gentle. Now you've got some healing to do. There's a hell of a void waiting to take us all if you fuck up. And if it comes..."
The smile went from Monday's face.
"If it comes, there won't be any more spirits in the light, because there won't be any light. Where's your familiar, by the way?"
"Who?"
"The mischief."
Gentle's breath quickened.
"You lost it once, and I went looking for it. I found it, too. Mourning its children, don't you remember?"
"Who was this?" Clem asked.
"You never met it," Taylor said. "If you had, you'd remember."
"I don't think Gentle does," Clem said, looking at the maestro's troubled face.
"Oh, the mischief's in there somewhere," Taylor said. "Once seen, never forgotten. Go on, Gentle, name it for me. It's on the tip of your tongue."
Gentle's expression became pained.
"It's the love of your life, Gentle,"
Taylor said, coaxing Gentle on.
"Name it. I dare you. Name it."
Gentle frowned and mouthed silence, but finally his throat gave up its hostage.
"Pie,"
he murmured. Taylor smiled through Monday's face.
"Yes?"
"Pie, oh, pa."
"What did I tell you? One scene never forgotten."
Gentle said the name again and again, breathing it as though the syllables were an incantation. Then he turned to Clem.
"That lesson I never learned," he said. "It came from Pie."
"Where's the mischief now?" Taylor asked. "Do you have any idea?"
Gentle went down on his haunches beside Tay's sleeping host.
"Gone,"
he said, closing his hands around the sunlight.
"Don't do that," Taylor said softly. "You only catch the dark that way."
Gentle opened his hand again and let the light lie on his palm.
"You say the mischief's gone," Tay went on. "Where, for God's sake? How can you lose it twice?"
"It went into the First Dominion," Gentle replied. "It died and went where I couldn't follow."
"I'm sorry to hear that."
"But I'll see it again, when I've done my work," Gentle said.
"Finally, we get to it," Tay said.
"I'm the reconciler," Gentle said. "I've come to open the dominions."
"So you have, maestro," Tay said.
"On Midsummer Night."
"You're cutting it fine," Clem said. "That's tomorrow."
"It can be done,"
Gentle said, standing up again.
"I know who I am now. He can't hurt me any more."
"Who can't?" Clem asked.
"My enemy,"
Gentle replied, turning his face into the sunlight. Myself.
2. After only a few days in this city, that enemy, the Suntime Autarch Sartori, had begun yearning for the languid dawns and elegiac dusks of the dominion he'd left. The day came altogether too quickly here and was snuffed out with the same alacrity. That would have to change. Among his plans for the new Isorderex would be a palace made of mirrors, and a glass made possessive by fates that would hold the glories of these inkling dawns and protract them, so that they met the glow of dusk coming in other directions. Then he might be happy here. There would be, he knew, little in the way of resistance to his taking of the fifth, to judge by the ease with which the members of the Tabula Rasa had succumbed to him. All but one of them was now dead, cornered in their burrows like rabid vermin. Not one had detained him more than minutes. They had given up their lives quickly, with few sobs and still fewer prayers. He wasn't surprised. Their ancestors had been strong-willed men, but even the most pungent blood thinned over generations, and the children of their children of their children and so on were faithless cowards. The only surprise he'd had in this dominion, and it was a sweet one, was the woman whose bed he was returning to, the peerless and eternal Judith. His first taste of her had been in Quasar's chambers when, mistaking her for the woman he'd married, he'd made love to her on the bed of veils. Only later, as he'd prepared to quit Isorderex, had Rosengarten informed him of Quasar's maiming and gone on to report the presence of a doppelganger in the corridors of the palace. That report had been Rosengarten's last as a loyal commander. When, a few minutes later, he'd been ordered to join his Autarch on the journey to the fifth, he'd unconditionally refused. The second was his home, he said, and Isorderex his pride, and if he was to die, then he wanted it to be in the sight of the comet. Tempted as he was to punish the man for this dereliction of duty, Sartori had no desire to enter his new world with blood on his hands. He'd let the man go and departed for the fifth, believing the woman he'd made love to on Quasar's bed was somewhere in the city behind him. But no sooner had he taken up the mask of his brother's life than he'd met her again, in Klein's garden of scentless flowers. He never ignored omens, good or bad. Judith's reappearance in his life was a sign that they belonged together, and it seemed that she, all unknowing, felt the same. Here was the woman for the love of whom this whole sorry catalogue of death and desolation had been started, and in her company he felt himself renewed, as though the sight of her reminded his cells of the self he'd been before his fall. He was being offered a second chance, an opportunity to start again with the creature he'd loved and make an empire that would erase all memory of his previous failure. He'd had proof of their compatibility when they'd made love, a more perfect welding of erotic impulses he could scarcely have imagined. After it, he'd gone out into the city about the business of murder with more vigour than ever. It would take time, of course, to persuade her that this was a marriage decreed by fate. She believed him to be his other, and would be vengeful when he disabused her of this fiction. But he would bring her around in time. He had to. He had intimations, even in this blithe city, of intolerable things, whispers of oblivion that made the foulest oviate he'd ever dredged up look alluring. She could save him from that, lick off his sweats and rock him to sleep. He had no fear that she'd reject him. He had a claim on her that would make her put aside all moral niceties. His child, planted in her two nights before. It was his first. Though he and Quasar had attempted to found a dynasty many times, she'd repeatedly miscarried, then later corrupted her body with so much crouchy it refused to produce another egg. But this Judith was a wonder. Not only had she made surpassing love with him, there was fruit from that coupling, and when the time came to tell her, once the irksome Oscar Godolphin was dead and the line for whom she'd been made stopped, then she would see the perfection of their union and feel it, kicking in her womb. 3. Jude hadn't slept, waiting for Gentle to return from another night of wanderings. The summons she carried from Celestine was too heavy to sleep with. She wanted it said and done so she could put her thoughts of the woman away. Nor did she want to be unconscious when he returned,
The idea of his coming in and watching her sleep, which would have been comforting 2 nights before, unsettled her now. He was the egg licker and its thief. When she had her possession back and he was gone off to Highgate, she'd rest, but not before. The day was creeping up when he finally returned, but there was insufficient light for her to read much on his face until he was within a few yards of her, by which time he was wreathed in smiles. He chastised her fondly for waiting up. There was no need, he said, he was quite safe. The pleasantries stopped here, however. He saw her unease and wanted to know what was wrong.
"I went to Roxburgh's tower," she told him.
"Not on your own, I hope. Those people can't be trusted."
"I took Oscar."
"And how's Oscar?"
She was in no mood to prettify. "He's dead," she said.
He looked genuinely saddened at this. "How did that happen?" he asked.
"It doesn't matter."
"It does to me," he insisted. "Please, I want to know."
"Dowd was there. He killed Godolphin."
"Did he hurt you?"
"No, he tried, but no."
"You shouldn't have gone up there without me. What on earth possessed you?"
She told him as plainly as she knew.
"Roxburgh had a prisoner," she said. "A woman he buried under the tower."
"He kept that little kink to himself," came the reply. She thought there was something almost admiring in his tone, but she fought the temptation to accuse him. "So you went to dig up her bones, did you?"
"I went to release her."
Now she had every scrap of his attention.
"I don't follow," he said.
"She's not dead."
"So she's not human." He made a curt little smile. "What was Roxburgh doing up there? Raising wantons?"
"I don't know what wantons are."
"They're ethereal whores.
That doesn't describe Celestine."
She trailed the bait of the name, but he failed to bite.
"She's human. Or at least she was."
"And what is she now?"
Jude shrugged.
"Something else. I don't quite know what. She's powerful, though. She almost killed Dowd."
"Why?"
"I think you're better off hearing that from her."
"Why should I want to?"
he said lightly.
"She asked to see you. She says she knows you."
"Really? Did she say from where?"
"No. But she told me to mention Nisi Nirvana."
He chuckled at this.
"Does it mean something to you?" Jude said.
"Yes, of course. It's a story for children, don't you know it?"
"No."
Even as she spoke, she realized why. But it was he who voiced the reason.
"Of course you don't," he said. "You were never a child, were you?"
She studied his face, wishing she could be certain he meant to be cruel, but still not sure that the indelicacy she'd sensed in him, and now sensed again, wasn't a new-found naivete.
"So will you go to her?"
"Why should I? I don't know her."
"But she knows you."
"What is this?" he said. "Are you trying to palm me off on another woman?"
He took a step towards her, and though she tried to conceal her reluctance to be touched, she failed.
"Judith," he said, "I swear I don't know this Celestine. It's you I think about when I'm not here."
"I don't want to discuss that now."
"What do you suspect me of?" he said. "I've done nothing, I swear."
He laid both his hands on his chest.
"You're hurting me, Judith. I don't know if that's what you want to do, but you are.
You're hurting me." "That's a new experience for you, is it?"
"Is that what this is about? A sentimental education? If it is, I beg you, don't torment me now. We've got too many enemies to be fighting with each other."
"I'm not fighting. I don't want to fight."
"Good," he said, opening his arms. "So come here."
She didn't move.
"Judith,
I want you to go and see Celestine. I promised her I'd find you, and you'll make a liar of me if you don't go."
"All right, I'll go," he said. "But I'm going to come back, love, you can depend on that. Whoever she is, whatever she looks like, it's you I want."
He paused. "Now more than ever," he said. She knew he wanted her to ask him why, and for fully 10 seconds she kept her silence rather than satisfy him. But the look on his face was so brimming she couldn't keep her curiosity from putting the question on her tongue.
"Why now?" she said.
I wasn't going to tell you yet.
Tell me what?
We're going to have a child, Judith.
She stared at him, waiting for some further explanation. That he'd found an orphan on the street, or was bringing a babe from the Dominions. But that wasn't what he meant at all, and her pounding heart knew it. He meant a child born from the act they'd performed. A consequence.
"It'll be my first," he said. "Yours too, yes?"
She wanted to call him liar. How could he know when she didn't? But he was quite certain of his facts.
"He'll be a prophet," he said. "You'll see."
She already had, she realized. She'd entered its tiny life when the egg had plunged her consciousness down into her own body. She'd seen with its stirring spirit a jungle city and living waters, gentle, wounded, and coming to take the egg from tiny fingers. Had that perhaps been the first of its prophecies?
"We made a kind of love no other beings in this dominion could make," Gentle was saying. "The child came from that."
"You knew what you were doing?"
"I had my hopes."
"And didn't I get a choice in the matter? I'm just a womb, am I?"
"That's not how it was."
"A walking womb?"
"You're making it grotesque."
"It is grotesque."
"What are you saying? How can anything that comes from us be less than perfection?"
He spoke with almost religious zeal. "I'm changing, sweet. I'm discovering what it is to love and cherish and plan for the future. See how you're changing me? From what? From the great lover to the great father? Another day, another gentle?"
He looked as though he had an answer on his tongue, but bit it back. "We know what we mean to each other," he said. "There should be proof of that. Judith, please." His arms were still open, but she refused to go into them. "When I came here, I said I'd made mistakes, and I asked you to forgive me if I did. I'm asking you again now."
She bowed her head and shook it. "Go away," she said.
"I'll see this woman if you want me to. But before I go, I want you to swear something to me. I want you to swear you won't try and harm what's in you."
"Go to hell."
"It's not for me. It's not even for the child. It's for you. If you were to do any harm to yourself because of something I did, my life wouldn't be worth living."
"I'm not going to slip my wrists, if that's what you think."
"It's not that."
"What then?"
"If you try to abort the child, it won't go passively. It's got our purpose in it. It's got our strength. It'll fight for its life, and it may take yours in the process. Do you understand what I'm saying?"
She shuddered. "Speak to me. I've got nothing to say to you that you want to hear. Go talk to Celestine."
"Why don't you come with me?"
"Just go away."
She looked up. The sun had found the wall behind him and was celebrating there, but he remained in shadow. For all his grand purpose, he was still made to be fugitive, a liar and a fraud. "I want to come back," he said. She didn't answer. "If you're not here, I'll know what you want from me." Without a further word, he went to the door and let himself out. Only as she heard the front door slam, did she shake herself from her stupor and realize he'd taken the egg with him as he went. But then, like all mirror lovers, he was fond of symmetry, and it probably pleased him to have that piece of her in his pocket, knowing she had a piece of him in a deeper place still.
Chapter 14. 1. Even though Gentle had known the tribe of the South Bank only a few hours, parting from them wasn't easy. He'd felt more secure in their company for that short time than he'd felt with many men and women he'd known for years. They, for their part, were used to loss. It was the theme of almost every life story he'd heard. So there were no histrionics or accusations, just a heavy silence. Only Monday, whose victimization at first stirred the stranger from his passivity, made any attempt to have Gentle linger.
"We've only got a few more walls to paint," he said, "and we'll have covered them all. A few days, a week at the most."
"I wish I had that long," Gentle told him, "but I can't postpone the work I came back to do." Monday had, of course, been asleep while Gentle talked with Tay, and had woken much confounded by the respect he got. But the others, especially Benedict, had new words to add to the vocabulary of miracles.
"So what does a reconciler do?" he asked Gentle. "If you're going off to the Dominions, man, we want to be coming with you."
"I'm not leaving Earth, but if and when I do, you'll be the first to know about it."
"What if we never see you again?"
Irish said. "Then I'll have failed."
"And you're dead and gone?"
"That's right."
"He won't fuck up," Carol said. "Will you, love?"
"But what do we do with what we know?"
Irish said, clearly troubled by this burden of mysteries.
"With you gone, it won't make sense to us."
"Yes, it will," Gentle said, "because you'll be telling other people, and that way the stories will stay alive until the door to the Dominions is open."
"So we should tell people?"
"Anyone who'll listen." There were murmurs of assent from the assembly. Here, at least, was a purpose, a connection with the tale they'd heard and its teller.
"If you need us for anything," Benedict purred, "you know where to find us."
"Indeed I do," Gentle said, and went with Clem to the gate.
"And what if anybody comes looking for you?"
Carol called after them. "Tell them I was a mad bastard and you kicked me over the bridge." This earned a few grins.
"That's what we'll say, maestro," Irish said. "But I'm telling you, if you don't come back for us one of these days, we're going to come looking for you."
The farewells are over. Clem and Gentle headed up onto Waterloo Bridge in search of a cab to take them across the city to Jude's place. It wasn't yet 6, and though the flow of northbound traffic was beginning to thicken as the first commuters appeared, there were no taxis to be had, so they started across the bridge on foot in the hope of finding a cab on the Strand.
"Of all the company to have found you in," Clem remarked as they went, "that has to be the strangest."
"You came looking for me there," Gentle pointed out. "So you must have had some inkling."
"I suppose I must.
And believe me, I've kept stranger company. A lot stranger."
"I believe it. I'd like you to tell me about the whole journey one day soon. Will you do that?"
"I'll do my best. But it'll be difficult without a map. I kept telling Pi I'd draw one, so that if I ever passed through the Dominions again and got lost,
you'd be found."
"Exactly."
"And did you make a map?"
"No. There was never time, somehow. There always seemed to be something new to distract me."
"Tell me as much as..." "Whoa, I see a cab."
Clem stepped out into the street and waved the vehicle down. They both got in and Clem supplied the driver with directions. As he was doing so, the man peered into his mirror.
"Is that someone you know?"
They looked back along the bridge to see Monday pelting towards them. Seconds later, the paint-smeared face was at the taxi window and Monday was begging to join them.
"You've got to let me come with you, boss. It's not fair if you don't. I gave you my colours, didn't I? Where would you be without my colours?"
"I can't risk your getting hurt," Gentle said.
"If I get hurt, it's my hurt and it's my fault."
"Are we going or what?" the driver wanted to know.
"Let me come, boss, please."
Gentle shrugged, then nodded. The grin which had gone from Monday's face during his appeal returned in glory, and he clambered into the cab, rattling his tobacco tin of chalks like a juju as he did so.
"I brought a callus," he said, "just in case we need 'em. You never know when we might have to draw a quick Dominion or something, right?"
Though the journey to Judith's flat was relatively short, there were signs everywhere, mostly small, but so numerous their sum became significant, that the days of venomous heat and uncleansing storm were taking their toll on the city and its occupants. There were vociferous altercations at every other corner, and some in the middle of the street. There were scowls and furrows on every passing face.
"Tay said there was a void coming,"
Clem remarked as they waited at an intersection for two furious motorists to be stopped from making nooses of each other's neckties.
"Is this all part of it?"
"It's bloody madness is what it is," the cabbie chimed in. "There's been more murders in the last 5 days than in all of last year. I read that somewhere. And it's not just murders, neither. It's people topping themselves. A mate of mine, a cabbie like, was up the arsenal on Tuesday, and this woman just throws herself in front of his cab, straight under the front wheels. Bloody tragic."
The fighters had finally been refereed and were being escorted to opposite pavements.
"I don't know what the world's coming to," the cabbie said. "It's bloody madness."
His piece said he turned on the radio as the traffic began moving again, and began whistling an out-of-tune accompaniment to the ballad that emerged.
"Is this something we can help stop?" Clem asked Gentle. "Or is it just going to get worse?"
"I hope the reconciliation will put an end to it, but I can't be certain. This Dominion's been sealed up for so long it's poisoned itself with its own shit."
"So we just have to pull down the sodding walls,"
Monday said, with the glee of a born demolisher. He rattled his tin of colours again.
"You mark 'em," he said, "and I'll knock 'em down. Easy."
2. The child, Jude had been told, had more purpose in it than most, and she believed it. But what did that mean, besides the risk of its fury if she tried to unhouse it? Would it grow faster than others? Would she be big with it by dusk, and her water ready to break before morning? She lay in the bedroom now, the day's heat already weighing on her limbs, and hoped the stories she'd heard from radiant mothers were true, that her body would pour palliatives into her bloodstream to ease the traumas of nurturing and expelling another life. When the doorbell rang, her first instinct was to ignore it. But her visitors, whoever they were, kept on ringing, and eventually began to shout up at the window. One called for Judy. The other, more oddly, for Jude. She sat up, and for a moment it was as though her anatomy had shifted. Her heart thumped in her head, and her thoughts had to be dragged up out of her belly to form the intention to leave the room and go down to the door. The voices were still summoning her from below, but they petered out as she headed down the stairs, and she was ready to find the doorstep empty when she got there. Not so. There was an adolescent there, besmirched with colour, who upon sight of her turned and hollered to her other visitors who were across the street, peering up at her flat.
"She's here!"
he yelled.
"Boss, she's here!"
They started back across the road towards the step. And as they came, her heart, still beating in her head, took up a suicidal tempo. She reached out for some support as the man at Clem's side met her eyes and smiled. This wasn't Gentle. At least it wasn't the egg thief Gentle who'd left a couple of hours before, his face flawless. This one hadn't shaved for several days, and had a brow of scabs. She backed away from the step, her hand failing to find the door, though she wanted to slam it.
"Keep away from me," she said.
He stopped a yard or two from the threshold, seeing the panic on her face. The youth had turned to him, and the impostor signalled that he should retreat, which he did, leaving the line of vision between them clear.
"I know I look like shit," the scabby face said, "but it's me, Jude."
She took two steps back from the blaze in which he stood. How the light liked him, not like the other who'd been in shadow every time she'd set eyes on him, her sinews fluttering from toes to fingertips, their motion escalating as though a fit was about to seize her. She reached for the banister and took hold of it to keep herself from falling over.
"It can't be," she said.
This time the man made no reply. It was his accomplice in this deceit, Clem, of all people, who said,
"Judy, we have to talk to you. Can I come in?" "Just you," she said. "Not them. Just you."
"Just me." He came to the door, approaching her slowly, palms out.
"What's happened here?" he said. "That's not Gentle," she told him. "Gentle's been with me for the last 2 days, and nights. That's... I don't know who."
The impostor heard what she was telling Clem. She could see his face over the other man's shoulder, so shocked the words might have been blows. The more she tried to explain to Clem what had happened, the more she lost faith with what she was saying. This Gentle, waiting outside, was the man she'd left on the studio step, standing bewildered in the sun as he was now. And if this was he, then the lover who'd come to her, the egg licker and fertilizer, was some other, some terrible other. She saw Gentle make the man's name with his lips. Sartori. Hearing the name and knowing it was true, knowing that the butcher of Isordrex had found a place in her bed, heart and womb, the convulsions threatened to overtake her completely. But she clung to the solid, sweaty world as best she could,
determined that these men, his enemies, should know what he'd done.
"Come in," she said to Gentle. "Come in and close the door."
He brought the boy with him, but she didn't have the will to waste on objecting. He also brought a question.
"Did he harm you?"
"No," she said. She almost wished he had, wished he'd given her a glimpse of his atrocious self. "You told me he was changed, Gentle," she said. "You said he was a monster. He was corrupted, you said. But he was exactly like you."
She let her rage simmer in her as she spoke, working its alchemy on the abhorrence she felt and turning it into purer, wiser stuff. Gentle had misled her with his descriptions of his other, creating in her mind's eye a man so tainted by his deeds he was barely human. There'd been no malice in his deception, only the desire to be utterly divided from the man who shared his face. But now he knew his error and was plainly ashamed. He hung back, watching her while the tremors in her body slowed. There was steel in her sinew, and it held her up, lent her the strength to finish the account. There was no sense in keeping the last part of Sartori's deceit from either Gentle or Clem. It would be apparent soon enough. She laid her hand on her belly.
"I'm pregnant," she said. "His child. Sartori's child."
In a more rational world, she might have been able to interpret the expression on Gentle's face as he received the news, but its complexity defied her. There was anger in the maze, certainly, and bafflement too. But was there also a little jealousy? He hadn't wanted her company when they'd returned from the Dominions. His mission as reconciler had scourged his libido. But now that she'd been touched by his other, pleasured by him, did he see that guilt somewhere on her face, as ineptly buried as his jealousy? He was feeling pangs of possessiveness. As ever with their story, there was no sentiment untainted by paradox. It was Clem, dear, comforting Clem, who opened his arms now and said, "Any chance of a hug?"
"Oh God, yes," she said. "Every chance."
He crossed to her and wrapped his embrace around her. They rocked together.
"I should have known, Clem,"
she said, too quietly for Gentle or the boy to hear.
"Hindsight's easy," he said, kissing her hair. "I'm just glad you're alive." "He never threatened me. He never laid a finger on me that I didn't
ask for."
"I didn't need to ask," she said. "He knew."
The sound of the front door reopening made her raise her head from Clem's shoulder. Gentle was stepping out into the sun again, with the youth following. Once outside, he looked up, cupping his hand over his brow to study the sky at his zenith. Seeing him do so, Jude realized who the sky watcher she'd glimpsed in the Boston Bowl had been. It was a small solving, but she wasn't about to spurn the satisfaction it provided.
"Sartori is Gentle's brother, is that right?" Clem said. "I'm afraid I'm still hazy on the family relations." "They're not brothers. They're twins," she replied. "Sartori is his perfect double."
"How perfect?" Clem asked, looking at her with a small, almost mischievous smile on his face.
"Oh, very perfect."
"So it wasn't so bad, his being here?" She shook her head.
"It wasn't bad at all," she replied. Then, after a moment, "He told me he loved me, Clem."
"Oh, Lord."
"And I believed him."
"How many dozens of men have told you that?"
"Yes, but he was different."
Famous last words. She looked at the sun watcher for a few seconds, puzzled by the calm that had come over her. Was the mere memory of his commitment to her enough to assuage every dread?
"What are you thinking?" Clem asked her.
"That he feels something Gentle never did," she replied. "Maybe never could. Before you say it, I know the whole thing's repulsive. He's a destroyer. He's wiped out whole countries. How can I be feeling anything for him?"
"You want the clichés?"
"Tell me.
You feel what you feel.
Some people go for sailors, some people go for men in rubber suits and feather boas. We do what we do. Never explain, never apologize."
"There, that's all you're getting."
Her hands went to his face. She cupped it, then kissed it.
"You are sublime," she said. "We're going to survive, aren't we?"
"Survive and prosper," he said.
but I think we'd better find your bow for everybody's—'
He stopped as her grip on him tightened. All trace of joy had gone from her face.
"'What's wrong?'
"'Celestine. I sent him up to Highgate, to Roxburgh's tower.
"'I'm sorry, I'm not following this.
"'It's bad news,' she said, leaving his embrace and hurrying to the front door.
Gentle relinquished his zenith watching at her summons and returned to the step as she repeated what she'd just told Clem.
"'What's up in Highgate?' he said.
"'A woman who wanted to see you. Does the name Nisi Nirvana mean anything to you?'
Gentle puzzled over this for a moment.
"'It's something from a story,' he said.
"'No, Gentle, she's real. She's alive. At least she was.'
3. It hadn't been sentiment alone that had moved the autarch Sartori to have the streets of London depicted in such loving detail in the walls of his palace. Though he'd spent only a little time in the city, no more than weeks between his birth and his departure for the reconciled dominions, Mother London and Father Thames had educated him right royally. Of course, the metropolis, visible from the summit of Highgate Hill, where he stood now, was vaster and grimmer than the city he'd wandered then, but there were enough signs remaining to stir some poignant and pungent memories. He'd learned sex in these streets, from the professionals around Drury Lane. He'd learned murder at the riverside, watching the bodies washed up in the mud on a Sunday morning after the slaughters of Saturday night. He'd learned law at Lincoln's Inn Field, and seen justice done at Tyburn. All fine lessons that had helped to make him the man he was. The only lesson he couldn't remember learning, whether in these streets or any other, was how to be an architect. He must have had a tutor in that, he presumed, at some time. After all, wasn't he the man whose vision had built a palace that would stand in legend, even though its towers were now rubble? Where in the furnace of his genes, or in his history, was the kindling spark of that genius? Perhaps he'd only discover the answer in the raising of his new Isorderex. If he was patient and watchful, the face of his mentor would sooner or later appear in its walls. There would have to be a great demolishing, however, before the foundations were laid, and banalities like the Tabula Rasa's tower, which he now came in sight of, would be the first to be condemned. He crossed the forecourt to the front door, whistling as he went, and wondering if the woman Judith had been so insistent he meet, this Celestine, could hear his trill. The door stood open, but he doubted any thief, however opportunist, had dared enter. The air around the threshold fairly pricked with power, putting him in mind of his beloved Pivot Tower. Still whistling, he crossed the foyer to a second door and stepped through it into a room he knew. He'd walked these ancient boards twice in his life, the first time the day before the reconciliation, when he'd presented himself to Roxburgh here, passing himself off as the Maestro Sartori for the perverse pleasure of shaking the hands of the reconciler's patrons before the sabotage he'd planned took them to hell. The second time, the night after the reconciliation, with storms tearing up the skies from Hadrian's Wall to Land's End. On this occasion he'd come with Chant, his new familiar, intending to kill Lucius Cobbett, the boy he'd made his unwitting agent in the sabotage. Having searched for him in Gamut Street and found him gone, he'd braved the storm. There were forests uprooted and lifted in the air, and a man struck by lightning burning on Highgate Hill, only to discover that Roxburgh's house was empty. He'd never found Cobbett. Driven from the safety of Gamut Street by his sometime maestro, the youth had probably fallen prey to the storm, as so many others had that night. Now the room stood silent, and so did he. The lords who'd built this house, and their children who'd raised the tower above, were dead. It was a welcome hush. In it there'd be time for dalliance. He wandered over to the mantelpiece and headed down the stairs, descending into a library he'd never known existed until this moment. He might have been tempted to linger, perusing the laden shelves, but the pricking power he'd felt at the front door was stronger than ever, and drew him on, more intrigued with every yard. He heard the woman's voice before he set eyes on her, emanating from a place where the restless dust was so thick it was like walking in a delta fog. Barely visible through it, a scene of sheer vandalism. Books, scrolls, and manuscripts, reduced to shreds or buried in the wreckage of the shelves they'd been laid upon. And beyond the rubble, a hole in the brick. And from the hole,
a call.
"Is that Sartori?"
"Yes," he said.
"Come closer. Let me see you."
He presented himself at the bottom of the heap of rubble.
"I thought she'd failed to find you," Celestine said. "Or else you'd refused to come."
"How could I refuse a summons like this?" he said softly.
"Do you think this is some kind of liaison?"
she replied.
"Some secret tryst?"
Her voice was raw with the dust and bitter. He liked the sound of it. Women who had anger in them were always so much more interesting than their contented sisters.
"Come in, maestro," she said to him. "Let me put you to rights."
He clambered up over the stones and peered into the darkness. The cell was a wretched hole, as sordid as anything beneath his palace, but the woman who'd occupied it was no anchorite. Her flesh hadn't been chastened by incarceration, but looked lush for all the marks upon it. The tendrils that clung to her body extolled her fluency, moving over her thighs and breast and belly like unctuous snakes. Some clung to her head and paid court at her honey lips. Others lay between her legs in bliss. He felt her tender gaze on him and luxuriated in it.
"Handsome," she said.
He took her compliment as an invitation to approach, but as he did so she made a murmur of distress, and he stopped in his tracks.
"What's this shadow in you?" she said.
"Nothing to be afraid of," he told her. Some of the filaments parted, and longer tendrils, these not courtiers but part of her substance, uncurled from behind her, clinging to the rough wall and hauling her up.
"I've heard that before," she said. "When a man tells you there's nothing to be afraid of, he's lying. Even you, Sartori."
"I won't come any closer if it bothers you," he said. It wasn't respect for the woman's unease that moved him to compliance, but the sight of the ribbons that had lifted her. Quasar had sprouted such appendages, he recalled, after her intimacies with the woman of the Bastion of the Banu. They were evidence of some facility in the other sex he had no real comprehension of, a remnant of crafts all but banished from the reconciled dominions by Hepexamendios. Perhaps they'd seen a new, poisonous flowering in the Fifth in the time since he'd left. Until he knew the scope of their authority, he'd be circumspect.
"I'd like to ask a question, if I may," he said.
"Yes."
"How do you know who I am?"
"First, tell me where you've been all these years."
Oh, the temptation he felt to tell her the truth then, and parade his achievements in the hope of impressing her. But he'd come here in the guise of his other, and, as with Judith, he'd have to choose the moment of his unmasking carefully.
"I've been wondering," he said.
It wasn't so untrue.
"Where?"
"In the Second Dominion,
and occasionally the Third."
"Were you ever in his Order X?"
"Sometimes."
"And in the desert outside the city?"
"There too." "Why do you ask?"
"I was there once, before you were born."
"I'm older than I look," he told her.
"I know it doesn't show."
"I know how long you've lived, Sartori," she replied. "To the very day."
Her certainty nourished the discomfort bred by the sight of the tendrils. Could she read his thoughts, this woman? If so, if she knew what he was and all he'd done, why wasn't she in awe of him? There was no profit in pretending that he didn't care that she seemed to know so much. Plainly but politely, he asked her how, preparing as he spoke a profusion of excuses if she were simply one of the maestro's casual conquests, and accused him of forgetting her, but the accusation, when it came, was of another kind entirely.
"You've done great harm in your life, haven't you?" she said to him.
"No more than most," he protested mildly.
"I've been tempted to a few excesses, certainly. But then hasn't everybody?"
"A few excesses?" she said. "I think you've done more than that. There's evil in you, Sartori. I smell it in your sweat, the way I smelled coitus in the woman."
Her mention of Judith,
Who else could this venereal woman be? Reminded him of the prophecy he'd made to her 2 nights before. They would find darkness in each other, he'd said, and that was a perfectly human condition. The argument had proved potent then. Why not now? It's just the humanity in me you can sense, he said to Celestine. She was clearly unpersuaded.
Oh, no, she replied. I'm the humanity in you.
He was about to laugh this absurdity off, but her stare hushed him.
What part of me are you? He murmured. Don't you know yet? She said. Child, I'm your mother.
Gentle led the way as they stepped into the cool of the tower's foyer. There was no sound from anywhere in the building, above or below. Where's Celestine? He asked Jude. She led him to the door into the Tabula Rasa's meeting room where he told them all. This is something for me to do, brother to brother.
I'm not afraid, Monday piped up.
No, but I am, Gentle said with a smile, and I wouldn't want you to see me piss my pants. Stay up here, I'll be out double quick.
Make sure you are, Clem said, or we're coming down to get you.
With that promise as comfort, Gentle slipped through the door into what remained of Roxburgh's house. Though he'd felt nothing in the way of memories as he'd entered the tower, he felt them now. They weren't as material as those that visited him in Gamut Street, where the very boards seemed to have recorded the souls that had trodden them. These were vague recollections of the times he'd drunk and debated around the great oak table. He didn't allow nostalgia to delay him, however, but passed through the room like a man vexed by admirers, arms raised against their blandishments, and headed down into the cellar. He'd had this labyrinth and its contents, all spined and skin-bound, whether human or not, described to him by Jude, but the sight still amazed him. All this wisdom, buried in darkness. Was it any wonder the magical life of the Fifth had been so anemic in the last 2 centuries, when all the liquors that might have fortified it had been hidden here? But he hadn't come to browse, glorious as that prospect was. He'd come for Celestine, who'd trailed, of all things, the name Nisi Nirvana to bring him here. He didn't know why. Though he vaguely remembered the name and knew there was some story to go with it, he could neither remember the tale nor recall whose knee he'd first heard it at. Perhaps she knew the answer. There was a wonderful agitation here. Even the dust would not lie down and die, but moved in giddy constellations, which he divided as he strode. He made no false turns, but the route from the steps to the place where Celestine lay was still a long one, and before he'd reached it he heard a cry. It wasn't a woman's cry, he thought, but the echoes disfigured it, and he couldn't be certain. He picked up his speed, turning corner after corner, knowing as he went that his other had preceded him every step of the way. There were no further cries after the first, but as his destination came in view, it looked like a cave raggedly dug from the wall, an oracle's home. He heard a different sound, that of bricks grinding their gritty faces together. There were small but constant falls of dried mortar from the ceiling, and a subtle trembling in the ground. He started up over the litter of fallen rock, which was strewn like a battlefield with gutted books, to the inviting crack. As he did so, he caught a glimpse of a violent motion inside, which had him to the threshold in a stumbling rush.
"Brother,"
he said, even before he'd found Sartori in the gloom, "what are you doing?" Now he saw his other, closing on the woman in the corner of the cave. She was almost naked, but far from defenceless. Ribbons, like the rags of a bridal train but made of her flesh, were springing from her shoulders and back, their power clearly more substantial than their delicacy implied. Some were clinging to the wall above her head, but the bulk were extended towards Sartori and wrapped around his head like a smothering hood. He clawed at them, working his fingers between them to get a better grip. Fluid ran from the gouged flesh, and cobs of matter came away in his fists. It could only be a matter of time before he released himself, and when he did, he'd do her no little harm. Gentle didn't call to his brother a second time. What was the use? The man was deafened. Instead, he crossed the cave at a stumbling rush and took hold of Sartori from behind, dragging his brother's arms from their maiming work and pinning them to his sides.
As he did so, he saw Celestine's gaze go between the two figures in front of her, and either the shock of what she was witnessing or her exhaustion took its toll on her strength. The wounded ribbons loosened and fell in wreaths around Sartori's neck, uncovering the other face and confirming Celestine in her distress. She withdrew the ribbons entirely, gathering them into her lap. With his sight returned, Sartori wrenched his head around to identify his captor. Seeing Gentle, he instantly gave up his struggle to free himself and stood in the Reconciler's arms quite pacified.
"Why do I always find you doing harm, brother?" Gentle asked him.
"Brother," said Sartori. "Since when was it brother?"
"That's what we are."
"You tried to kill me in his order, X, or have you forgotten?"
"Has something changed?"
"Yes," said Gentle.
"I have."
"Oh?"
"I'm ready to accept our kinship."
"A fine word."
"In fact, I accept my responsibility for everything I was, am, or will be. I've got your Oviat to thank for that."
"That's good to hear," Sartori said, "especially in this company."
He looked back at Celestine. She was still standing, though it was plainly the filaments hugging the wall that held her up, not her legs. Her eyes were flickering closed, and there were tremors running through her body. Gentle knew she needed aid, but he could do nothing while he was burdened with Sartori, so he turned and pitched his brother towards the cave door. Sartori went from him like a doll, only raising his arms to break his fall at the very last.
"Help her if you want," he said, staring back at Gentle with slackened features. "It's no skin off my nose."
Then he lifted himself up. For an instant, Gentle thought he intended some reprisal and drew breath to defend himself. But the other simply said,
"I'm on my belly, brother. Would you harm me here?"
As if to prove how low he'd fallen and was willing to stay, he began to slink over the earth like a snake driven from a hearth.
"You're welcome to her," he said,
and disappeared into the brighter murk beyond the door. Celestine's eyes had closed by the time Gentle looked back, her body hanging limply from the tenacious ribbons. He went towards her, but as he approached, her lids flickered open.
"No," she said, "I don't want you near me."
Could he blame her? One man with his face had already attempted murder, or violation, or both. Why should she trust another? Nor was this any time to be pleading his innocence. She needed help, not apology. The question was, from whom? Jude had made it clear on the way up that she'd been sent from this woman's side the same way he was being sent. Perhaps Clem could nurse the woman.
"I'll send somebody to help you," he said, and headed out into the passageway.
Sartori had disappeared, lifted himself off his belly and taken to his heels. Once again, Gentle went in his footsteps back towards the stairs. He'd covered half that distance when Jude, Clem and Monday appeared. Their frowns evaporated when they saw Gentle.
"We thought he'd murdered you," Jude said.
"He didn't touch me. But he's hurt Celestine and she won't let me near her. Clem, will you see if you can help? But be careful, she may look sick, but she's strong."
"Where is she?"
"Jude'll take you. I'm going after Sartori."
"He's gone up the tower," Monday said. "He didn't even look at us," Jude said. She sounded almost offended. "He just stumbled out and up the stairs. What the hell did you do to him?"
"Nothing."
"I never saw an expression like that on his face before. Or yours, come to that."
"Like what?"
"Tragic," said Clem.
"Maybe we're going to win a quicker victory than I thought," Gentle said, starting past them to the stairs.
"Wait," Jude said. "We can't tend to Celestine here. We need to take her somewhere safer."
"Agreed."
"The studio, maybe?"
"No," Gentle said. "There's a house I know in Clerkenwell where we'll be safe. He drove me out of it once. But it's mine. And we're going back to it. All of us."
Chapter 15 1 The sun that met Gentle in the foyer put him in mind of Taylor, whose wisdom, spoken through a sleeping boy, had begun this day. That dawn already seemed an age ago,
The hours since then had been so filled with journeys and revelations. It would be this way until the reconciliation, he knew. The London he'd wandered, in his first years, brimming with possibilities, a city Pye had once said hid more angels than God's skirts, was once again a place of presences, and he rejoiced in the fact. It gave heat to his heels as he mounted the stairs, two and three at a time. Strange as it was, he was actually eager to see Sartori's face again, to speak with his other and know his mind. Jude had prepared him for what he'd find on the top floor, bland corridors leading to the tabula rasa's table, and the body sprawled there. The scent of Godolphin's undoing was there to meet him as he stepped into the passageway, a sickening reminder, though he scarcely needed one, that revelation had a grimmer face, and that those last halcyon days, when he'd been the most lauded metaphysician in Europe, had ended in atrocity. It would not happen again, he swore to himself. Last time the ceremonies had been brought to grief by the brother waiting for him at the end of this corridor, and if he had to commit fratricide to remove the danger of a recurrence, then so be it. Sartori was the spirit of his own imperfections made flesh. To kill him would be a cleansing, and welcome, perhaps, to them both. As he advanced along the corridor, the sickly smell of Godolphin's putrefaction grew stronger. He held his breath against it and came to the door in utter silence. It nevertheless swung open as he approached, his own voice inviting him in. "There's no harm in here, brother. Not from me. And I don't need you on your belly to prove your good intentions." Gentle stepped inside. All the drapes were drawn against the sun, but even the sturdiest fabric usually let some trace of light through its weave. Not so here. The room was sealed by something more than curtains and brick, and Sartori was sitting in this darkness, his form visible only because the door was ajar. "Will you sit?" he said. "I know this isn't a very wholesome slab." The body of Oscar Godolphin had gone, the mess of his blood and rot remaining in pools and smears. "But I like the formality. We should negotiate like civilized beings, yes?" Gentle acceded to this, walking to the other end of the table and sitting down, content to demonstrate good faith unless or until Sartori showed signs of treachery. Then he'd be swift and calamitous. "Where did the body go?" he asked. "It's here. I'll bury it after we've talked. This is no place for a man to rot. Or maybe it's the perfect place. I don't know. We can vote on it later." "Suddenly you're a Democrat. You said you were changing. So am I." "Any particular reason?" "We'll get to that later. First..." He glanced towards the door, and it swung closed, plunging them both into utter darkness. "You don't mind, do you?" Sartori said. "This isn't a conversation we should have, looking at ourselves. The mirror's bad enough." "You didn't mind in his order, X. I was incarnate there. Here I feel immaterial. I was really impressed by what you did in his order, X, by the way. One word from you and it just crumbled away." "Your handiwork, not mine." "Oh, don't be obtuse. You know what history'll say. It won't give a fuck about the politics. It'll say the reconciler arrived and the walls came tumbling down, and you're not going to argue with that. It feeds the legend. It makes you look messianic. That's what you really want, isn't it? The question is, if you're the reconciler, what am I?" "We don't have to be enemies. Didn't I say the very same thing in his order, X, and didn't you try and murder me?" "I had good reason." "Name one." "You destroyed the first reconciliation." "It wasn't the first. There have been three other attempts to my certain knowledge." "It was my first. My great work. And you destroyed it." "Who did you hear that from?" "From Lucius Cobbett," Gentle replied. There was a silence then, and in it Gentle thought he heard the darkness move, a sound like silk on silk, but
But his head was never quite silent these days, and before he could clear a path through the whispers, Sartori had recovered his equilibrium. "So Lucius is alive," he said.
"Just in memory. In Gamut Street."
"That fuckhead little Ease let you have quite an education, didn't he?
I'll have his guts."
He sighed. "I miss Rosengarten, you know. He was so very loyal. And Residio, a Matalaus. I had some good people in his Order X, people I could trust, people who loved me. It's the face, I think. It inspires devotion. You must have noticed that. Is it the divine in you, or is it just the way we smile? I resist the notion that one's a symptom of the other. Hunchbacks can be saints, and beauty's perfect monsters. Haven't you found that?"
"Certainly."
"You see how much we agree. We sit here in the dark and we talk like friends. I truly think if we never again stepped out into the light, we could learn to love each other. After a time."
"That can't happen."
"Why not?"
"Because I've work to do and I won't let you delay me."
"You did terrible harm last time, Maestro. Remember that. Put it in your mind's eye. Remember how it looked, seeing the Inovo spilling out." By the sound of Sartori's voice, Gentle guessed that the man had risen to his feet. But again it was difficult to be certain when the darkness was so profound. He stood up himself, his chair tipping over behind him. "The Inovo's a filthy place," Sartori was saying, "and believe me, I don't want it dirtying up this dominion. But I'm afraid that may be inevitable." Now Gentle was certain there was some duplicity here. Sartori's voice no longer had a single source, but was being subtly disseminated throughout the room, as though he was seeping into the darkness.
"If you leave this room, brother, if you leave me alone, there'll be such horror unleashed on the Fifth. I won't make any errors this time."
"Who's talking about error?" Sartori said. "I'm talking about what I'll do for righteousness' sake if you desert me."
"So come with me."
"What for? To be your disciple? Listen to what you're saying. I've got as much right to be called Messiah as you. Why should I be a piddling acolyte? Do me the courtesy of understanding that, at least."
"So do I have to kill you?"
"You can try."
"I'm ready to do it, brother, if you force me."
"So am I. So am I." There was no purpose in further debate, Gentle thought. If he was going to kill the man, as it seemed he must, he wanted to do it swiftly and cleanly. But he needed light for the deed. He moved towards the door, intending to open it, but as he did so, something touched his face. He put his hand up to snatch it away, but it had already gone, flitting towards the ceiling. What defense was this? He'd sensed no living thing when he'd entered the room other than Sartori. The darkness had been inert. Either it had now taken on some illusory life as an extension of Sartori's will, or else his other had used the darkness as a cover for some summoning. But what? There had been no evocations spoken, no hint of a fate. If he'd managed to call up some defender, it was flimsy and witless. He heard it flapping against the ceiling like a blinded bird.
"I thought we were alone," he said.
"Our last conversation needs witnesses, or how would the world know I gave you a chance to save it?"
"Biographers now?"
"Not exactly."
"What then?"
Gentle said, his outstretched hand reaching the wall and sliding along it towards the door.
"Why don't you show me?"
he said, his palm closing around the handle.
"Or are you too ashamed?"
With this, he pulled not one, but both doors open. The phenomenon that followed was more startling than dire. The meagre light in the passageway outside was drawn into the room in a rush, as though it were milk, sucked from day.